This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It takes a lot of nerve to talk about global warming just after a blast of Arctic weather in the Northern Hemisphere. But our furnaces, cars, and factories are still churning out even more global warming gases day in and day out. It's going to catch up to us. Scientists report big changes are already occurring well ahead of previous predictions. We're back with one of our go-to guys on the cutting edge. Paul Beckwith has two master's degrees and is working on his doctorate in climate science at the University of Ottawa. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. It's cold outside, and that's sort of one of the things we're going to be talking about. But I'd like to start with the big methane debate going on among scientists right now. As part of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, AMEG, you're tuned in to alarming developments around the polar sea. What is the latest?
Well, there's been a lot of activity on the methane front in the last month or so. I'll start with a couple sort of landmark reports that have come out. Of course, there's the IPCC AR5 Working Group 1, which is the physical basis of climate change. There's that document, and that document came out at the end of October. It's good timing for you asking me this question, because I just completed, just a few days ago, I completed reading the entire document, which is 2216 pages, so it's quite a feat in itself. But that document is basically saying that the consensus view is that the knowledge on methane is uncertain still. We don't know everything we would like to know about it, especially in the Arctic, in the terrestrial permafrost, and also the marine, which is the ocean sediment permafrost, both permafrost and clathrates, methane clathrates. There's still uncertainty, but the consensus view of the document is that methane will not come out in significant amounts this century to cause us a problem. I don't agree with that finding, but I'll get to that after. Just 2 days ago, there was a National Research Council document that came out on abrupt climate change. Both the abrupt climate change is one thing, and that's the changes in the physical system that happen very quickly. When we say abrupt, we talk about something happening much faster than the normal slow linear change. So we're talking about a nonlinear change. We're talking about some threshold being crossed, and then rapid changes in the system. Malcolm Gladwell talked about it as tipping points. He coined that phrase, and a lot of people use that. And then there's also abrupt climate impacts, which this NRC document is talking more about, and that's there can be abrupt changes in human response and human effects, even though the climate is only changing linearly. For example, if the sea level is rising at a certain rate, it can reach a point where it overtops the seawall. So the effects on that particular city where the seawall was overtopped is an abrupt impact of climate change. It's not necessarily an abrupt change in the system. So this NRC document is talking about that. And once again, they basically take the IPCC stance that methane is not a huge problem. Now, there is politics at play here, because one of the very influential people on both the IPCC report and the NRC report is David Archer. He's very well known in the field. He's written numerous books, including books called Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, and things like that. So he's a heavyweight in the field, and he is, I don't want to use the term methane denier, but he studied methane intensively, but he's a modeler. He doesn't get out in the field. So in the models, it's showing, they use slab models of the ocean floor, for example, like a 1D model, and they try to see how quickly heat can go down based on thermodynamics, and then once the heat goes down, it can melt frozen clathrates or permafrost under the seafloor and then cause methane to release. Now, those models show that we're talking about a century sort of time scale to get significant emissions. There's that document. Those are the two that are saying methane will not be a problem. And then let's look at the research. Let's look at the data and the numbers, okay? The most significant paper that came out just recently in the last week or so is a Shakova paper. She's the head author. It's on ebullition or bubbling from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf. It's sort of an update of her paper. So it's a bunch of Russians. They go out there and they do the measurements. They went out in 2010 and they wrote a paper in 2010. What we just found out recently is that when they went out in 2010, they went out, there was a massive storm and they thought that they were in trouble, so they radioed for help. The Russians sent a tugboat to tow the ship to safety, but the tugboat sank in the rescue attempt and 11 lives were lost, 11 Russian Coast Guard lives were lost. And at the time, they just said that the ship was out there and sank. They didn't say it was rescuing the scientists who were studying the effect of storms on methane. But so the 2013 paper has not an acknowledgement, but it discusses, you know, it dedicates the paper basically to the lives of those Russians that were lost. And the big thing about this paper is that the rates of methane coming up from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf are increasing greatly. Of course, this information, the 2010 paper would be considered in the documents, the IPCC documents and the NRC document, but of course not the 2013 paper. And it shows that the methane rates have more than doubled, coming like on a per square meter of seafloor basis over that basin. And anecdotal evidence is that where they measure bubbling using sonar, I guess it's not anecdotal, but if you just go there and you see bubbling coming up, then you can measure the extent of the bubbling from sonar. And that shows a large increase in the area of the bubbling. It was tens of meters years ago, and then a year or two ago, it changed to kilometer-wide bubbling regions. And of course, the final paper that was very significant was it turns out that the methane measurements of methane coming up over the United States are far exceeding values that were previously thought by the Environmental Protection Agency, which was measuring sort of individual sites to see what is coming up. And this most recent paper, which shows much, much bigger releases, is measuring the atmospheric levels.
Yes, I talked to Scott Miller of Harvard, who was the lead author on that study, and it was definitely surprising that the EPA had been actually reducing their estimates of methane rising up from the fossil fuel industry at a time when it was twice as big as they were reporting. So that was a very alarming study. But I want to get back a little bit to the Arctic here. I've been looking at maps provided by Sam Carana of methanetracker.org, as published in the Arctic News blog. And they're really rather frightening because they show higher and higher than normal levels of methane coming up in the winter. And this is what got me. How could methane rise right across what must be frozen seas in the winter? How can methane come up through the ice cover?
Yes, even though, you know, we're of course in the winter season where the ice is thickening, but there's always going to be fractures in the ice. The ice is not a fixed entity. It's always in motion. There's always fracturing going on. There's always these areas of open ocean called polynas. There's areas of breakage in the ice where there's open water, and from those areas, lots of heat can come out. But basically, there's a lag in the ocean. So during the melt season in the boreal summer, when the ice is decreasing in extent and thinning, there's lots of open water exposed around the outskirts of the ice. And that ocean water is very dark, of course, and it's absorbing lots of solar energy in the northern summer. So during freeze-up, the atmosphere is colder. It cools the upper surface of the water. You get the ice forming, but the water underneath is still warm, and it's the warmer water underneath. There's a couple things. First of all, over the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf, it's very shallow. The maximum depth is 50 meters. So the water is warm going down to the very bottom, and it melts the sediments on the ocean floor, and it percolates downwards and can cause methane, frozen methane, to be released. But also warmer water cannot dissolve as much gas, so it can't hold as much methane. So the methane, as it seeps up from the ocean floor, cannot be held in the water. It has to come out, and then it escapes through the fractures and cracks in the ice to come up into the atmosphere. That's why we're seeing really high levels now, recently, even higher than we saw in the summer, because the water has been in contact with the frozen sediments and it's been melting it over time. And it takes a long time to cool down that water. So the water under the ice is still very warm.
So what is the normal measurement of methane around the world and what are we seeing in the Arctic?
Yeah, typical values of methane are about 1850 parts per billion. And that's sort of like a global average. And there is there is latitudinal contrast depending on where you are relative to source regions. So the typical maximum emission source regions are wetlands near the, in terms of natural emissions, are wetlands near the equatorial regions. But of course, in the equatorial regions, there's also very high temperatures, very high evaporation, lots of water vapor in the atmosphere, which produces the hydroxyl molecule, which is the main molecule which removes methane from the atmosphere. So although the sources are high there, there's also lots of sinks. Whereas when you go up into the Arctic, we're getting increasing sources of methane from both terrestrial and marine sediments and clathrates. And it's very dry up there. There's much less water, so there's much less hydroxyl. So the methane is not broken down as quickly up there, which sort of gets me into the global warming potential of methane, which you hear, like people talk about, you know, how does methane, how much more important is one methane molecule at heating the atmosphere compared to one molecule of CO2? And this gets into the global warming potential. Now, this is a number that is changing continuously. It's continuously increasing in IPCC reports. So the latest report had the global warming potential of methane relative to CO2 being 34 times on a 100-year timescale, a century timescale, whereas the last IPCC report had that number being 25. The one before, the previous one, two reports ago, had that number being 23, I believe, and then, or 22, and then going back even further to the prior report, it was 21. So the number has evolved from 21 up to 25 in the last report and up to 34, and that's a significant difference. So methane is acting on the climate in a stronger way with the release of each new report that comes out. Now, the century timescale is not the significant one for the Arctic. What's more important is what's happening on, say, a 20-year timescale or what's happening even on a few-year timescale. And if you go to sort of the 20-year timescale, the latest number for the global warming potential of methane is it's either 80 or 84. I think it's 84, whereas the previous IPCC report had a number of 70 for the global warming potential. And then if you go to the a few-year time scale, the number is over 100. So methane coming up in the Arctic over the ice, because of the circulation patterns of the atmosphere over the Arctic and the polar vortex, and because of the Coriolis force, when things try to move south, everything is deflected to the right. So you can think of the Arctic region, the atmosphere is kind of having circulation patterns that confine gases. They don't mix as much as they would, say, at the equator. So methane that is emitted up in the Arctic will stay in the atmosphere in the Arctic longer than it would elsewhere further from the pole, and it also has a high global warming potential. And it also has a longer lifetime because there's less hydroxide. So you can calculate the radiative forcing of the methane in the Arctic compared to CO2. It is much, much higher. And the methane tracker site measured levels as high as 2,600, over 2,600 parts per billion. And you can compare that to the 1850 global average number. And the satellite, it's two satellites that are measuring it. There's the IASI satellite. There's also an AERS satellite. Those are acronyms for spectrometers that measure in the infrared the methane signature. So they measure the concentrations. And it's also been confirmed with on-ground weather station flask measurement data at Barrow, Alaska, for example, and at Svalbard. And those numbers correlate, those numbers agree, basically with the satellite data, which gives you a sort of a view of methane levels at each different level of the atmosphere.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest is Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. Paul, I'd like to move on to get your take on this latest report on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and I can already feel some listeners becoming impatient, ready to tune out, and that tells you a lot about how far public perception has fallen about these reports. Is the IPCC still relevant to the developing climate crisis?
The IPCC is a, first of all, you know, the group itself is a very, very loosely knit group. They have very little overhead, very few people employed. It's probably less than 10. And what they do is they ask scientists to volunteer. Once a scientist volunteers, went for one, they're very keen to do it again. But they basically get a collection of all of the peer-reviewed scientific papers that have come out since the previous report. So they'll use the previous report as sort of a base for the new report, and they'll try to analyze the probabilities, like how good the data is, whether it's robust, whether it's sparse. They'll put a likelihood on an occurrence. They'll say things are extremely likely or very likely. They'll assign a probability to that. It's basically groups of expert scientists headed by sort of lead authors, and then they all basically write this report. And I mean, the IPCC basically is just an organizational body to collect this information together, to set up the conferences, to discuss it, and so on. So the report is excellent. It's interesting what they're doing this year is they're releasing Working Group 1 was released October 27th or 28th. Working Group 2 is going to be released in March. That's adaptation. And then Working Group 3 towards the end of next year, I think, or maybe shortly after March. I don't know exactly when, but it's for mitigation. And when they release the report, they're putting disclaimers. Don't quote it. Don't reference it. This is a draft. So the, that way, you know, 3 or 4 months after it's initially released, the draft is released, then they have a lot of feedback. They can make changes if they've made mistakes in things. I mean, I've caught some mistakes myself, like duplicate graphs in a couple places and things like that. But, you know, I mean, there's no way you can put together a document 22, 16 pages long without some typos and without some inaccuracies and things. So I think it's a very relevant document. Of course, you have to be cognizant of the cutoff date, which is the last date at which they'll accept a peer-reviewed paper. And I think that date, I've heard some different numbers for that, but it's about March of this year. So if a paper came out after that, then it's not in the document. So I think moving forward, rather than, you know, put these massive documents out every 6 years or so, it would be better to have sort of, updates like they do some specific updates on a specific topic, but it would be nice to have just an update, like what is the new science that has come out in the last year or two since the last IPCC report? But how the probabilities changed and things like that. But I mean, it's a very good starting point. Like if somebody is researching, you know, some graduate student goes and they want to do a research in a certain area, you know, they can go to the IPCC. It's very well referenced. They can find out what's been done in the field up to that date. And then look at all papers more recent and, you know, get a good sort of start on their own research. But you do have to be careful because for policymakers, I mean, you know, they go through the document before it's released and people have to buy into the wording. And, you know, you're always going to be watering down. Like it's always going to be underestimating things. It's not going to be going out on a limb saying something is going to happen. It's always going to be a more conservative view because it does involve a consensus of a large number of people.
Let's try and take the positive view. First of all, what did you find that is new and important for our listeners to understand in this report?
Well, it does the idea that, you know, humans' emissions and land use change are causing the warming. I mean, that's like it's obvious to somebody studying it. It's obvious, you know, with my background in molecular spectroscopy, yes, the CO2 molecule is, you know, infrared active. You get higher concentrations, you get more infrared, which is more heat. And so the certainty that we're causing the warming, the certainty is ever increasing with each report. Also, the modeling in the report, I mean, there's more and more groups around the world that are getting involved with modeling the different parameters of the climate and atmosphere, like basically the temperatures, the rainfalls, the responses of the system to large greenhouse gas forcings. There's more and more groups on board, and the models are getting more sophisticated. The models are taking into account the carbon. We've moved from what they call AOGCMs, which is atmosphere, ocean, general circulation models, which are very extensive models, and they've added carbon cycling and carbon feedbacks and the feedbacks from biology, like more warmer, more CO2, perhaps more vegetation growth. Those models are being incorporated into it, and more feedbacks are, and they've gone to a term, Earth System Models. This is a step above the AOGCM model. So they're always evolving in the process, but there's still key things that are not being modeled accurately. And I would say that, the sea ice models are getting better, but what we're seeing real time in the Arctic with the sea ice in terms of the exponential decline of volume is not being modeled accurately, because these models model the entire planet and the sea ice is a part of it. There was also a model that was, there's a U.S. Navy model at the Naval Research Center. There's Maslowski is a modeler there, and they've got an extremely high resolution, very small grid size, regional model of the Arctic. So it's a regional model. It's not doing the whole planet. It's just doing the Arctic, trying to look at all the feedback, seeing what the ice is doing. And this model is projecting that the sea ice could be gone in September of 2016, as early as 2016. If you extrapolate the exponential decline of sea ice volume, then that's about the year when it shows a drop to zero also.
Shocking stuff. Well, Paul Beckwith, as you probably know, James Hansen at the beginning of December just released another paper saying the warming limit assumed by all the climate negotiators and the governments is far too dangerous. He says 2 degrees centigrade, and I think that's around 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Correct me if I'm wrong. But that point is already beyond tipping points that will wreck the world as we know it. What is your take on that?
All the policy conferences and so on, we've heard this 2-degree warming as a threshold limit on safety for quite a while. I should point out that that's 2 degrees above the pre-industrial temperature. So we've already risen close to, 0.8 degrees Celsius. So the 2 degrees is an additional 1.2 degrees of warming over where we are today. So the recent Hansen paper, which is not just Hansen, I think it's about 17 different people involved in the paper, are saying that one degree is basically the limit. We're up 0.8, so we're within the 0.2 degrees of reaching that level that Hansen's talking about. So what's going on? What's happening? Well, what's happening is that there's other factors that are kicking in to make, clearly the extreme weather events around the world have been, I'll use the term skyrocketing. It's not a very scientific term, but it's probably a good descriptive term of what's actually happening. We're getting the intensity of extreme weather event. Let's talk about the main event that is affecting humanity, and that's torrential rain events. Okay, so the intensity of torrential rain events is increasing. I can talk about the Calgary flooding. I can talk about the Toronto flooding. We can talk about India. We can talk about Germany and Europe, which flooded all the rivers there. What we're getting, Colorado is another good example. What we're getting is we're getting a month or 2 months or 6 months or a year's worth of rainfall in a region that normally happens over that time period in a region. We're getting that to happen within a few days or so. Or even in some cases, we're getting 6 months equivalent of rainfall in a few hours. So we're getting huge rises in intensity of torrential rain events. The duration of these events is longer because the jet streams have slowed. The storms tend to track the jet streams, and the jets are slowing, so the storms are slowing, so they're sticking over. They're not moving across regions as quickly, so they're dumping huge amounts of rain. We're also getting the jet streams are changing location. So we're getting storms occurring like this where they didn't occur before. So the spatial extent of the storms is changing, and also the frequency of occurrence is changing. What we used to say, a 1 in 100 year, 1 in 200 year event, we're getting repeat events of these things within several years, at places. So the statistics is changing. And this gets back to the Arctic warming. The Arctic is warming extremely rapidly. The greenhouse gases are increasing. We're getting overall warming. But because of the albedo effect, the declining sea ice and snow cover and Greenland reflectance, we're getting the drop in albedo or reflectance in that region. So we're getting more in the summer up in the northern hemisphere, we're getting more absorption of shortwave radiation, which is causing localized regional heating in that region. And because that region is heating at up to 5-6 times higher than the global average temperature, it's changing the temperature gradient between the Arctic and the equator. The physics of moving air in the rotating system means that the jet streams have to basically, there's less flow rate, there's less volume flow rate in the jet stream, there's less transport from the equator to the North Pole, both in the atmosphere and the ocean circulation. So the ocean current patterns change and the atmospheric patterns change, which is reflected in the jet streams changing. So they're becoming wavier, and we've been seeing this time and time again. In 2010, the crest of the wave was over Russia. Russia had a massive heat wave, 40% grain crop loss, whereas the trough of the wave was over Pakistan. It rained for almost a full month, flooded out three-quarters of the country. We're seeing the exact thing right now in North America. Okay, so the crest of the wave is over the Alaska region. And partly Asian and Alaska, the Alaska region, Siberia, Eastern Asia and Alaska. So there's a huge ridge up there. So it's extremely warm. It's blocking the normal motions of the air. So what it does is if you have a huge ridge, you have to have a huge trough. And the huge trough is settling over North America, over Western North America. So that's why the temperatures, they're just in the trough, you're being fed by very cold Arctic air. In the ridge, you're being fed by humid equatorial air, marine air. And this pattern is sticking. It's set up and it's not moving. It's kind of stuck. Its location is determined by land-sea contrast and other factors, not so much by the normal motion of the jet. So we've got this pattern set up, and this is why we're getting record events, weather records, low-temperature weather records galore being broken, like in huge numbers, because this trough is just stuck over the continent. So the weather patterns are completely changing. And I relate it all back to the declining sea ice changing the temperature different. I believe this also explains why the Antarctic sea ice is growing and reaching record levels. It's because the Arctic amplification warming is 4 to 5 times that of the global average, we're getting the equator, there's less need for heat to flow from the equator to the North Pole. So that heat doesn't just stay at the equator, it therefore flows to the southern hemisphere. So there's more heat flowing from the equator to the southern hemisphere. But what it's doing is it's moving south, but it's not reaching Antarctica. What it does is it sets up an increased temperature gradient between the regions north of Antarctica and the region where you have a circumpolar flow around Antarctica. So what it's doing is it's increasing the speed of the jet streams that are traveling around Antarctica. So it's causing surface cooling over Antarctica. And so we're getting this 1.5% increase in sea ice per decade over the last few decades in that region. The mass of the Antarctic continent is still dropping because the water is warmer and it's going underneath and it's undercutting the sea ice, melting the sea ice from below. But I think this explains why the sea ice is still increasing. And the IPCC models all show that it should be decreasing in Antarctica. So the models don't quite have the entire system modeled quite correctly yet, but they're getting better all the time.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned in with Radio EcoShock from the University of Ottawa. Our guest is Paul Beckwith. And I just spoke with one of your compatriots there, Robert Way, from the University of Ottawa Geography Department, and he said that in a scientific paper published with another British co-author that major institutes have missed at least half of the warming actually happening on Earth. How did that strike you?
Yes, Robert he's in a cubicle just across from me, actually. Yeah, it's a very interesting paper because his area is really, he looks at permafrost and things. He's from Labrador. He studies that a lot, studies that area a lot, but he's been involved with Skeptical Science, the website Skeptical Science, and I think he met, people on that site, some of them being like the gentleman that he did the recent paper showing the missing warming, basically negating the idea of a hiatus or a pause in the warming since between 1998 and the present day. I believe the main author of that paper is a statistics guy. He's a math statistics background. So I think they met through the Skeptical Science website and started analyzing the temperature data from the climate research unit in Britain, the UK, the main temperature database there, and also the American one, the GIST one, Goddard Institute of Space Science, and they saw that the sparsity of the data just wasn't there in the north, so the warming was being underpredicted, underrepresented in the model. So what they did is they took satellite data, which could measure the temperatures at the top of the atmosphere, and they correlated that to a surface temperature. So they filled in all the missing points, and instead of a decadal warming of 0.05 or something. It was at least 2.5 times faster than that based on their paper. But another region that's not covered accurately is over Africa and also over Antarctica. Now, they did try to get satellite data from those regions to also put in their model, but I think it was the Antarctic stuff. I think there's still some work that can be done on the Antarctic stuff. And since Antarctica is also warming faster than the global average, I wouldn't be surprised if a follow-up paper to that paper comes out at some point showing that the warming is even greater than what they determined.
Well, we're running out of time, and there's a whole shopping list of things I wanted to talk to you about, like fracking in Britain and all that. We're just not going to get there. But I do want to sort of wrap up by asking you, there are times when I feel like our biology and our brains are not up to the challenge of what we're doing with fossil fuels. Do you have moments of despair?
I did. It's very rare that happens to me now. My background is engineering physics, and I worked, and then I did a master's in laser physics, and I was working, in the telecommunications field and in various other fields over the years. Computer software was another one. But I've been concerned about climate change and global warming for as long as I can remember. I mean, and I just decided that, you know, the rates of change were extremely disturbing to me. So I decided, okay, bite the bullet, and I started back at the University of Ottawa, almost 4 years ago, started a master's in climate change. And I went up to my supervisor at the time then, I think our very first meeting, and I said, I want to study abrupt climate change. So, and he's a pollen guy, looks at lake sediments and things and gets temperatures and precipitation, say, in the last 1,000 years or a few thousand years in North America. This is completely not his field, although he does have training in meteorology, good training. Conrad Gajewski is his name. And I said to him, I said, I want to do a master's. I said, I may switch to a PhD, but I'm willing to commit to a master's right now in abrupt climate change. And he said, well, I don't know if there's, you know, he was a bit skeptical of that topic 4 years ago. I mean, when you think about it, you know, 4 years ago, I mean, I really thought, okay, it's either the sea ice is the weak point in the climate system or the Amazon rainforest, because in 2005, there was a massive drought killing millions of trees and the Amazon became a net source of carbon instead of a sink. And extreme weather events were starting to take off and so on. But, you know, in the last 4 years, there's been tremendous changes. The public is waking up. I mean, they can't avoid waking up because these extreme weather events are just taking out roads and pipelines and rail and cities, causing huge, huge amounts of damage. And I really think that the extent of these extreme weather events, that as bad as they are now, I think as the sea ice continues to decline, if it is gone, I think these extreme weather events will ramp up at least an order of magnitude 10 or 20 times as the sea ice vanishes. So, and of course, the cost of these things will rise proportionately. As long as I stick to the science and just try to, I mean, my goal is to understand the climate system, all the part chunks of it, and to educate the public as to, you know, not just keep my knowledge for scientific papers. My objective has been to do the learning and to communicate my knowledge to the public. In order to get the PhD degree, you know, I'm going to be focusing on peer-reviewed published papers, three or four of them over the next year. One will be in the Arctic ice and snow. Another one will be exclusively methane. Then another one will be, okay, now when the Arctic is warming, how does that affect the jet streams and the circulations and extreme weather? And then a fourth one will tie all the elements together, like will there be cascading? If the sea ice goes, does that cause the rainforest to collapse? Does that cause a big change in the monsoons? You know, so the big, I'm basically looking from my experience with the climate system, I'm looking at the elements that I think are the most important, and I want to make a scientific contribution, a peer-reviewed paper in each of those areas. So that's my sort of goal. So it's just, you know, I have three kids, you know, I have to kind of compartmentalize. I mean, I do my work, it shows how bad the system's getting, and so on, and then I go home and have a normal life with my family. So I have to kind of segregate and separate the things, and I'm very good at doing that now. I think a lot of professions require that. I mean, if you're an emergency room person, you know, or a paramedic or something, I mean, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have your family life, then you go out and you see mangled bodies, and then you go home and have dinner and do normal stuff. You have to compartmentalize different parts of your life in order to psychologically deal with what's happening. But I'm very optimistic because I felt very alone in my views of how bad the climate system was getting, you know, over the last number of years until much more recently. I mean, I'm seeing reports all the time about the changes, and we've got to do something. And so I feel I'm getting a lot more company. There's a lot more people that are getting on board and educated as to the problems. So, you know, eventually it will reach a societal tipping point, and, you know, the fossil fuel industry will phase down like the horse and buggy industry, you know, 100 odd years ago.
Well, I think you've really hit it, Paul. I mean, I keep making radio programs, and you keep studying and communicating about climate change. And at the same time, we have personal lives where happiness still comes in, and we still enjoy the people around us. And we all have to do that. I think if our listeners can both become climate activists, keep themselves educated, and make sure that they have a positive personal life, we'll make it through this. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking climate change with scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. Find links to some of the stories we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you again for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
No doubt you've heard that fossil fuel emissions are turning the world's oceans more acidic. Scientists are scrambling to find out what that means for our future. There's a new report out based on a meeting of 540 experts from 37 countries held in Monterey, California in September 2012. It was the third symposium on the ocean in a high CO2 world. Radio EcoShock is pleased to welcome one of America's top ocean scientists, Dr. Richard Feeley. He's from NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. Hello, Dr. Feeley.
Hello. Glad to be on your show.
Well, it isn't like a more acidic ocean is going to burn our skin when we go swimming or anything, but it can damage sea creatures that depend on calcium for shells. Why should we care about that?
Well, in the seafood industry, many of our calcifying organisms represent about 50% of the total economic value of our seafood, particularly here in the United States, where about $2 billion a year are related to calcifying organisms such as shrimp, lobster, clams, oysters. In fact, the oyster industry is having a significant number of problems right now because of ocean acidification.
As I read through the report, I became alarmed for our own future as much as small sea creatures because the symposium agreed oceans are soaking up to 24 million tons of CO2 a day, but that buffer may not keep working as well. Can you explain what's happening with that?
Yes. There's a natural process by which carbon dioxide that's released into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuel, coal, oil, and natural gas. Mankind's been releasing about, as you said, 70 million tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every day, and about 22 million is absorbed by the oceans. This is a process of air-sea exchange of gases into the oceans. And that ocean uptake has caused a change in the pH, a lowering of the pH. And since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we have observed a decrease in the pH, about 0.1 units, which represents a 30% increase in the acidity of the oceans on a global basis.
Well, our CO2 emissions keep setting new records. If that continues into a worst-case scenario, what happens to the oceans by 2100?
Depending on what CO2 emission scenarios we are looking at, there is a range of scenarios. But the trajectory that mankind is in right now, we would expect to see a increase in atmospheric CO2 out to about 800 parts per million. And associated with that would be about a 0.3 to 0.4 decrease in the overall pH, which would be an increase in the acidity of the oceans of about 100 to 150%.
Some people, as you know, continue to doubt that human carbon emissions really cause climate change, but there is zero doubt in this paper that fossil fuel burning is changing the chemistry of the sea. How can scientists be certain of that?
Oh, well, we have a global ocean carbon observing system throughout the world oceans. They consist of moorings that are deployed. There are, right now, there are 32 moorings throughout the world oceans that have carbon sensors on them. In addition to that, we put CO2 sensors on ships of opportunity that transfer back and forth between continents. And we collect surface ocean data from those ships of opportunity. And we have discrete cruises that measure the water column chemistry from surface to bottom in what was called the International Ghost Ship Program that studies the chemistry of the oceans, say, from Antarctica to Alaska or from Japan to the U.S. These are decade-long cruises, and that allows us to determine the changes in chemistry throughout the water column. So we have very detailed chemical measurements that actually allows us from measurements alone to determine the changes in the CO2 concentrations in the oceans.
So the report also has high confidence that if we reduce emissions, ocean acidification will not be as bad. How do we know that?
Well, we also combine these data sets with models, and the models are based on the CO2 emission scenarios, the IPCC CO2 emission scenarios, and so they allow us to assess what the uptake of carbon dioxide and the change in pH would be under the different CO2 emission scenarios. The RCP 2.6 versus it would be the lowest concentration scenario, and the RCP 8.5 being the largest, highest concentration scenarios. And they represent atmospheric concentrations at the 2100, ranging from anywhere from about 500 parts per million CO2 all the way up to about 850 parts per million. So the models allow us to determine what the impacts on the ocean for those various CO2 emissions might be. And then from the observations, we're able to verify those models.
And will the impact that we're having continue for a long time?
Yes, that's one of the concerns about ocean acidification. The ocean circulation is really quite slow. It takes about 1,500 years or so for the entire circuit from the North Atlantic to the South Atlantic to through the Indian Ocean and back up to the North Pacific. And so consequently, the neutralization of all that CO2 takes a very, very long time. And so as we continue to take up CO2 into the oceans, it will take a longer and longer time for that CO2 to be neutralized. For example, if we have a business-as-usual scenario, where the atmospheric concentration would reach about 850 parts per million, it would take well over 10,000 years for the CO2 levels to get back to normal when we shut off those CO2 emissions. Whereas if we cut off CO2 emissions right now, we could see returning to normal within a few hundred years.
When scientists talk about the rate of acidification, the numbers seem quite small. Why does a 0.1 change in pH reflect a big change in the chemistry?
Well, pH is much like the Richter scale. It's actually a logarithmic scale. So a 1 pH unit change is actually a tenfold change in the concentration of the acidity of the oceans. So when we say that it's been a 0.1 pH change since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that's a 30% increase in the hydrogen ion concentration. That's more than anything we've seen over the last 50 million years.
And we shouldn't, as the report says, consider ocean acidification in a vacuum. How does a more acid ocean interact with things like warmer seas or even overfishing?
Many of these processes interact with each other to enhance the acidification effect. For example, coral reefs, when you look at the combined effects of acidification and global warming together, the impacts on corals are much worse because of the combined impact of increasing temperature and increasing acidification than either one of those two effects by themselves. And so from an ecosystem perspective, we would be concerned about how these combined impacts would occur. In a climate change world where the CO2 levels are increasing and the surface temperatures are increasing, the combined impacts on many of our marine ecosystems are more severe.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Pacific Marine Lab. Our guest is scientist Dr. Richard Feely. We're talking about making the oceans more acidic by burning fossil fuels. Richard, dead zones are popping up. Some people on the Internet are afraid the ocean is dying. What do you think about that?
No, that's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is that some species of organisms are highly sensitive to ocean acidification. Other species actually do better in a high CO2 world. But those species that are of importance to mankind for food resources, many of those species, particularly those species that have a calcium carbonate shell or skeleton, they are very, very sensitive to ocean acidification. So we're very concerned about that. When we look at the different species of organisms that are important food sources for mankind, a large portion of those species are affected by ocean acidification. On the other hand, seagrasses and other species of marine plants like cyanobacteria or jellyfish, they do well in a high CO2 world. So what we'd expect to see is significant species shifts in a high CO2 world. And the ramifications of those shifts through the ecosystem are yet to be understood.
Well, you bring that up. The scientists have high confidence in the cause and solution to ocean acidification, but predicting the economic and social costs came with low confidence. Why is that?
Well, what we know for certain is the chemistry of ocean acidification. We know that quite well because the observations are very, very clear and they are consistent with the models. So there's high confidence about the chemistry of ocean acidification. There's also high confidence about the impacts that we would have on some of our fishery species, particularly clams and oysters, where the experimental evidence is very, very clear. And with respect to oysters, for example, we know that there is an economic impact right now from the experiences we've had on the west coast of North America and California, Washington, Oregon, which are already seeing impacts of ocean acidification on their industries. The extension of that kind of effort and that kind of understanding to the global oceans is not as clear yet. And so we have a medium confidence on those kinds of economic impacts to this state.
You know, I've interviewed scientists who believe human geoengineering is needed to save the Arctic ice, perhaps by spraying sulfur aerosols. How would that affect the problem of ocean acidification?
Most of those geoengineering approaches address the cooling of the atmosphere. They don't address the amount of carbon dioxide that would be taken up by the oceans. So by neglecting the root cause of climate change, CO2, and its uptake in the oceans, most of those geoengineering approaches will not have any helpful impact on ocean acidification. And in some cases, for example, with iron fertilization and other approaches like that, it may actually enhance the acidification of the oceans. So there's a lot of research that has yet to be done to address what the overall impact would be.
Is there a safe level of ocean acidification? And second question, is there a tipping point where ecosystems will not recover?
Well, what we have learned so far is that each species of organism has a mechanism to either respond to acidification in a very negative way, in which we have tipping points for those organisms. For example, for oyster larvae, there's a fairly clear tipping point for the Pacific oyster. But other organisms have an ability to adapt to these changes, so the tipping points would be quite different. So we're faced with the situation of looking at this from one organism to the next to understand the responses and the adaptability of those organisms to acidification. And the research on adaptation is just getting started over the last 2 or 3 years, so we have a lot to learn about that process.
To me, changing the chemistry of the ocean seems like a huge step. Are scientists rallying around the need to find out more about this, and are national governments paying attention?
Yes, very much so. Within the United States, for example, there was a Federal Ocean Acidification Research and Monitoring Act of 2009 that focused 8 federal agencies to work together on ocean acidification. So there's a national program on ocean acidification. And at the same time, we have been working internationally through the efforts of the International Ocean Acidification Coordination Center in Monaco to coordinate the activities of at least right now 29 nations working to develop an ocean acidification observing system at the international level and developing research plans and priorities in order to coordinate all our efforts at the international level.
Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know?
When I give my presentations on ocean acidification, I always remind them that we as human beings have a very significant decision to make, and that's how we continue to use fossil fuels for energy and the implications of that for the health and welfare of our natural ecosystems. Decisions that we make over the next 30 to 50 years represents a change in the chemistry of the oceans that will be with us for hundreds of thousands to millions of years. So these are very, very important decisions that we need to make, and they have very serious implications for our marine ecosystems.
Our guest has been Dr. Richard Feely from NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. He's one of the authors of an international report called Ocean Acidification, Summary for Policymakers, Third Symposium on the Ocean in a High CO2 World. Find links to that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Richard Feely, thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next up, a clip from radio broadcaster Tom Hartman from his video at thelasthours.org.
Consider this. Nearly all life on Earth could go extinct because of man-made climate change. It's hard to imagine Earth without life. We take life for granted, but life has not always flourished here. The Earth has experienced dramatic loss of life, or what we call mass extinctions, 5 times over the course of geologic history. Each one of these events has resulted in the loss of more than half of all life on Earth. And the largest and most devastating of all was the Permian mass extinction. Almost all life on Earth disappeared.
Permian mass extinction is, in essence, just the greatest crisis that life on Earth has ever suffered.
By the end of the Permian mass extinction, 95% of all life on the planet was dead. And why is this important today? Because today, a 6th extinction is underway, one that will test the survival of not just human civilization, but possibly of the human species itself. And it bears a horrifying resemblance to several previous global warming-driven events, like the Permian mass extinction.
I think it is certainly extremely significant that a lot of the main crises of the past are associated with global warming, and so with obvious implications for the present day.
These warmed the atmosphere of the Earth by at least 6 degrees Celsius. That much global warming took a huge toll on land, animals, and plants. But far worse, it warmed the oceans enough that methane, frozen deep under the sea, melted and was released into the atmosphere. That enormous release of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, pretty much doubled the level of global warming and killed off over 95% of all life, both on Earth and in the seas.
It's a kind of a scary thought, but maybe one of the best geological analogs for the kinds of rapid changes in climate and CO2 in the atmosphere that we're going to witness now and for the next few centuries, potentially, is this end Permian time when, as you know, that culminated in one of the largest mass extinctions that we know of.
And of course, looking at these ancient events shows us times of global warming. And the atmosphere doesn't care whether the carbon dioxide comes from human activity or from a volcano. It has the same end effects.
The numbers are very similar from some of these giant lava flows in Siberia. The amount of carbon dioxide they release is very similar to the sort of fossil fuel burning carbon dioxide release that we're doing sort of decade after decade today.
Today, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is above 400 parts per million, a level not seen any time in the history of human life on Earth.
We are increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere at rates far greater than any of the most rapid events that happened in the deep geological past. There is no precedent for what we are doing to the atmosphere. It is an uncontrolled experiment.
At the end of 2012, the World Bank issued a report warning governments around the world that a 5-degree temperature increase is likely unless drastic action is taken to curb carbon emissions. There's a virtual scientific consensus that 6 degrees was all it took to initiate the PETM. In both cases, it involved massive releases of methane.
We know that in the bottom of the seafloor, large parts of the ocean margins have methane in a solid phase. And what happens is when you change the temperature, it can dissociate, or you can think of it as melting this.
Methane is way worse than carbon dioxide. It's inert right now in the soil. It's not affecting anybody in any way. When you warm it, it becomes a gas. Then it starts acting immediately as a greenhouse gas. So this is an immediate and very short-term threat to planetary civilization.
The risk is so-called runaway greenhouse, which is the self-correcting mechanism cease to kick in, and you heat by a little bit, and you release methane. That then causes excess heating, and you release more methane, and so it goes on.
That's probably the biggest issue that we face. Sea level change is a big one, too, a very expensive one to manage. But the methane release from the tundra, once that gets underway, we reach a point where we lose the option of having an effective mitigation strategy. That becomes unmanageable. So that's unfortunately kind of a doomsday scenario that our trajectory is pointed to.
Most disconcerting, the Arctic ice sheet that keeps the carbon stable is melting rapidly. In July 2013, the Arctic lost 41,000 square miles, an area half the size of Kansas, every single day. And scientists have witnessed kilometer-wide columns of methane gas bubbling up from the ocean floor, suggesting the tipping point to runaway climate change is dangerously close. While it appears we've already passed the tipping point for an ice-free Arctic in the summer, other tipping points could be centuries, generations, or just years down the road. The big danger about tipping points is that you can only recognize them when it's too late to do anything about it. So why should we risk these catastrophic events? In the case of climate change, our planet's life support system is at stake. So it is our obligation to take every precaution to stop it. We must begin to reduce carbon emissions dramatically. Yet, at this moment, we're facing a crisis of world leadership. Powerful fossil fuel corporations are fighting to monetize the trillions of tons of carbon they own that's still underground. The world community, global citizens, governments, leaders, NGOs, and corporations must come together, step forward, and take decisive action. Let's continue the research, but let's not wait until we pass more tipping points. This is the most urgent of times, and a most urgent message. Please forward this to as many people as you can.
That was Tom Hartman. Find the video at thelasthours.org. You can get more about this show in the blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock.